Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Healthcare Committee, April 6th. I would like to open. Should we start with the public hearings?
Sure.
Yeah. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 934. Oliver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 934, brought to you by Senator Steiner Hayward. The bill would require CCOs to spend at least 14.4% of their global budget on primary care and community health. Provides Oregon Health Authority with rulemaking authority to establish penalties if a CCO fails to meet the spending requirement. Exempt CCOs from the penalty if the CCO increases its spending on primary care or community health by at least 1% from previous calendar year. Provides Department of Consumer Business Services with rulemaking authority to require insurance carriers that do not spend 14.4% on primary care to submit plans for increasing spending on primary care. Requires insurance carriers participating in a federal program to offer the same payment methodologies to all patient-centered primary care homes, often referred to PCPCHs in Oregon. No impact statements, and we have no amendments yet.
Howdy. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate District 17. And Mr. Droppers did a lovely job giving a summary of the bill. That being said, there's a lot of details that are changing. So what I would appreciate the committee doing is paying attention to the overall substance and rationale behind the bill and not the specific numbers at this point, because those are still in flux. There will be a new amendment heading your way, and I'll be talking about what's in that amendment. I'm going to take a minute just to give you some background. You will remember that in 2015, this committee and then the full legislature passed Senate Bill 231, which established the Primary Care Payment Reform Collaborative, which is a group of CCOs, commercial insurers, health policy experts, and more, who are looking at ways of transforming how we pay for primary care. The fee-for-service model, as this committee has discussed on multiple occasions, is really broken, and it doesn't reward the kinds of care delivery that we know actually helps us reach the triple or even quadruple aim of better health care, better outcomes, and lower costs and increased provider satisfaction, which actually contributes to all of the above. The collaborative includes payers, providers, hospitals, and others, and has been looking at a wide range of changing how we pay for frontline preventive and chronic care and chronic disease management. Since then, the group's been meeting regularly and has offered a set of recommendations which have been endorsed by the Health Policy Board, and those are available in OLIS for your consideration as well. I've also met with the collaborative on multiple occasions to discuss their work, and Senate Bill 934 is in large part a reflection of their report and the general work that they have done. We know that increased spending does, in fact, reduce healthcare costs and improve health. And, in fact, a well-designed study done by Portland State University that's also available in OLIS for your reading pleasure demonstrates that Oregon's patient-centered primary care home resulted in $240 million of savings for healthcare costs over the first 3 years of its work. And those cost savings only increased the more years of practice was involved in the PCPCH model. The collaborative recommends aligning payment models for all payers, all patients, all primary care practices, and to increase the primary care spend from around double of what it was reported in 2014. The other thing that Senate Bill 231 did was it had the health authority establish definitions of what characterizes spending on primary care, and had all CCOs and commercial insurance companies report their percent spends based on those criteria to the health authority and DCBS. And those data have now been collected for 2 years and have been published and are available. We see a wide range, ranging from 6% to about 16%. And we are looking to increase. Ultimately, the percent spend, instead of the 14.4 originally referred to, will be targeting at about 12% over time. The health authority and DCBS would set standards for CCOs and commercial insurers, respectively, that will require them to invest in primary care either through the Comprehensive Primary Care Plus Initiative, which we've also heard about in this committee, that's an expansion of the CPCI program, Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative Program, that was originally done, or because the CPC Plus program does not allow us to provide alternative payment methodologies to federally qualified health centers or rural health centers, or to practices that do not have at least 150 Medicare patients, which rules out all of our pediatric practices, to expand those methodologies to all primary care practices that participate in the patient, in Oregon's patient-centered primary care home model. And they will set by rule how that is supposed to happen, how their increases are supposed to happen, what these kinds of APMs would be. We do not believe that a one-size-fits-all model in terms of alternative payment methodologies makes sense. We believe that different practices will benefit from different kinds of APMs. Different insurers or CCOs may want to experiment with different kinds of APMs, and we think that's entirely appropriate. The goal is to learn which ones work best in which circumstances and to ultimately reach this goal of increasing the average percent spend on primary care to at least 12% of premium. And this will also apply to PEB and OWEB because we think that those are important. It's important for the state. It also will extend the work of the collaborative to have it sunset 10 years from now in 2027 because we believe that this work will be ongoing. And it's important to have a group that has been well established, has learned how to work well together, to be able to respond to the different models, show how well they work or don't work. And last but not least, the bill will require this collaborative to work closely with the Metrics and Scoring Committee task force that was set up under Senate Bill 440, which this committee also considered in the 2015 session and whose work has just begun at the beginning of 2017, because what we don't want, while having multiple alternative payment methodologies may make sense, having multiple different metrics from different payers doesn't make sense because it means that providers and practices spend too much time doing paperwork, and it's really hard to compare apples to apples when you're working towards different goals. You will hear from people much more expert than I about more details on this, and I look forward to their testimony, although I'll be happy to take any questions prior to them starting.
Have you worked with the Oregon Health Authority on this?
Yes, ma'am.
And the Health Policy Board?
Yes, ma'am.
So you're all on the same page.
Yeah, there may be some nuances that require some work, but they are very supportive of this work. And, in fact, you will be hearing from the Health Authority. Dr. Rickers will be speaking around the Health Authority to talk about the ways that the Health Authority has engaged with the work of the patient-centered, the primary care payment reform collaborative, and the work, the intersection with the Health Policy Board.
Yeah, and again, you and I have already talked about this. I would love recommendations to come from the Health Policy Board to see what we need to do so we don't overload the system and put the cart before the horse, et cetera. Because when I found out there was, 176 pages to the contracts for CCOs, or maybe it's 76 pages. Anyway, a lot of pages for each contract. And then we're just adding one more thing to them, one more thing.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your concern, but in fact, this may end up simplifying it because we're trying to give them flexibility about how they achieve this goal. And it's a kind of metric that's appropriate for the state to hold the CCOs in particular accountable for, because ultimately we know that this will save us money and help us keep to the 3.4% inflation rate, or hopefully even a little bit lower. I do appreciate your concern. We are looking, in fact, to minimize administrative complexity, which is why we set up this metrics and scoring committee, so that all CCOs and all insurance companies will be using identical metrics.
And we can agree to just disagree, but that's okay. It's good work anyway.
All right. Anything else I can do? Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Let's call up Jim Rickards and Scott Fields.
All right. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Rickards, Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority, for the record. I'm with Dr. Scott Fields from Oregon Health Sciences University. Thank you for allowing me some time to present the Senate Bill 231 Primary Care Payment Reform Collaborative Recommendations and Feedback on Senate Bill 934. The agenda, first I'm going to speak briefly about how we are supporting primary care in the state of Oregon to provide some context for the committee and understanding the recommendations. Then we'll move on and discuss the Senate Bill 231 work, touch briefly on the primary care spending report, and then move on to the recommendations that the collaborative put forward. And then I'll turn it over to Dr. Fields to discuss the Senate Bill 231 collaborative's feedback on Senate Bill 934. So when it comes to supporting primary care in Oregon, we do this in a number of ways. One main way in which we do this is with our patient-centered primary care home program, or PCPCH program, administered by the Oregon Health Authority. This is a recognition program whereby if clinics voluntarily apply and meet a certain set of standards, then they'll be recognized as a PCPCH. We have 647 clinics in this program currently. Recently, Portland State University put out a report demonstrating the financial benefits of this program. As was previously noted, it's generated over $240 million in savings, resulting in a 4.2% reduction in expenditures per person, and produces a 13-to-1 ROI, meaning for every dollar spent on primary care delivered in a PCPCH, $13 in savings in other areas such as decreased hospitalizations or decreased emergency department visitations is generated. However, that report from Portland State University noted that existing payment models do not necessarily incentivize clinics to align with the PCPCH aims, so we need to do something to improve how we pay for primary care in the state. Additionally, Oregon was one of five states that was part of the CPCI program, the Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative program, which was sponsored by CMS. This was a multi-payer initiative designed to try to change and improve the way primary care is paid for. We had 65 clinics participate in this, generating over $12.8 million in savings in Medicare costs. And we're now going to be continuing in the second iteration of this program known as CPC Plus, and I'll touch on that here in a bit. So Senate Bill 231, as was previously mentioned, this was a piece of legislation passed to improve the way in which primary care was paid for. The bill essentially called for two pieces of work to be performed. One piece was the production of a primary care spending report. This report was designed to show what percentage of major carrier spending went to primary care. The second report was just produced this year. It's going to be produced annually through 2020. The different thing about this year's report as opposed to last year's was this year the payers in the report, their names were unblinded along with the amounts that they paid, so it was very clear and transparent who was paying what. From the report, we saw that our CCOs were leading the pack. They were paying the most for primary care. On average, about 12.5% of their expenditures went to primary care. Commercial payers, Medicare Advantage, OAB, and PEB weren't far behind. The report also looked at what percent of spending made by the payers was made in a non-claims-based fashion. So in other words, what percent of payments were made in a capitated fashion, a care management type fee, a performance-based payment. And again, we saw our CCOs were leading the pack at about 64%. The second main piece of work the collaborative or the SB 231 legislation called for was the creation of a primary care payment reform collaborative. The charge of this was to direct greater healthcare resources and investments towards supporting and facilitating healthcare innovation and care improvement in primary care. The Oregon Health Authority pulled together this multi-stakeholder collaborative composed of payers, both commercial and CCOs, representatives from professional organizations, the hospital association, nursing association, primary care providers, etc. And they met monthly from April through November of 2016. One of the first actions the collaborative took was to request that Oregon apply for recognition as a CPC Plus region or state. We worked with CMS over the course of last year and gained recognition, so we're now one of these CPC Plus states. CPC Plus, again, it's a program designed to pull together multiple different types of payers, commercial, Medicare Advantage, Medicaid, etc., to try to align their payment efforts to move away from fee-for-service payments to use models such as care management fees and performance-based payments. So we're now going to be participating in that for the next 5 years. The collaborative also developed a set of recommendations which have been presented to the Oregon Health Policy Board. They endorsed the recommendations, and these have been submitted to the legislature and then incorporated into Senate Bill 934. go through the recommendations the collaborative made. Again, these recommendations were in six areas. They made recommendations regarding measurement. They felt primary care should be measured using a limited number of standardized quality, utilization, and patient experience metrics that align with existing measurement efforts, so again, not to be duplicative, and also that their measurement efforts should align with the work of Senate Bill 440, which is currently being stood up, that group to devise some standardized health measurement metrics across the state. Regarding data aggregation, the collaborative felt a single source of aggregated data based on agreed-upon metrics should be used, and that aggregation should be sustainable and equitably financed through a shared utility model by all participants. Regarding technical assistance, they felt technical assistance should be delivered to practices and payers through a centralized structure via a sustainable shared funding model. Regarding primary care behavioral health integration, they felt payers should develop value-based primary care payment models that support primary care behavioral health integration, and that mental health and substance use carve-outs that impact behavioral health services should be invisible to service recipients and providers and not impact care. Then regarding collaborative governance, they felt that the collaborative should continue to be the long-term convener for all payers and providers to seek alignment and agreement around sustainable resourcing for primary care infrastructure and transformation. And then finally, the payment model. The collaborative felt the overriding goal of the any changes in the payment model should be there should be multi-payer alignment on both payment and performance incentive methodologies over 5 years, and that there should be a doubling of the 2014 aggregate average commercial spend that was found in the primary care spending report. They also felt that a key milestone should be that by the end of 2018, payers should align with federal payment goals by encouraging 50% of all payers' primary care payments to be attributed to value-based payments. In other words, they wanted to see alignment with what CMS is doing with the MACRA and the quality performance payment programs. CMS is moving Medicare payments to value-based methodologies with that goal of moving 50% of all payments to value-based methodologies by the end of 2018. The collaborative wanted to see that in Oregon as well. And then finally, the collaborative wanted to use CPC Plus as a guiding framework for payment models, so looking to have care management fees and performance-based payments in place to support primary care. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Fields. He has some feedback from the SB 231 collaborative on Senate Bill 934.
Great. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Senators. This is my first time testifying, so feel free to interrupt me and ask questions. I feel a little bit humbled to follow Senator Steiner and Dr. Rickards here, so I'm going to do the best I can. I'm a family doc, and I've been in practice in the same practice for over 30 years. I provide care.
You need to say your name.
I apologize. I am Scott Fields, and again, it's an honor to be here. Thank you. I'm a family physician, and I've been in the same practice for over 30 years. I care for patients in the clinic and in the hospital. I deliver babies, and I take care of patients in nursing homes. It's an honor to be here representing the Primary Care Payment Reform Collaborative that was created under Senate Bill 231. The collaborative met on March 10th with Senator Steiner Hayward, and we found that in general, Senate Bill 934 aligned extremely well with what was the recommendations that you just heard in regards to Senate Bill 231 collaborative recommendations. But there was a group that wanted to get together and provide additional feedback, and Senator Steiner Hayward recommended that we go ahead and do that. And so based upon that feedback, I'd like to share the areas where we feel that Senate Bill 934 can be revised in order to address some basic principles. And maybe I'll start with the basic principles. The basic principles are increased investment in primary care, alignment across the payers, a drive towards continual improvement in care, and payment aligned to that care model, and include emerging efforts to address the social determinants of health. Those are the four basic principles that really we wanted to make sure were embedded in the work that's involved in Senate Bill 934. So The feedback on the legislation from this work group differs slightly from the previous full collaborative recommendations in the following ways. First of all, in regards to increasing spending on primary care and target determination, beginning in January 1 of 2018, payers not participating in multi-payer primary care payment models, such as CPC Plus, at a minimum must increase their primary care spend at least 1% from the previous year, up to an initial payment for primary care expenditure target of 12%. The purpose of this language is to ensure that non-CPC Plus payers increase their primary care spend during the next year by at least 1%.
So just to clarify,
thank you.
The bill says 14.4,
correct.
So we'll be having amendment
yes,
coming
ma'am.
In. Thank you.
The CPC Plus payers will not be held to the same goal during the first year because they will be increasing their primary care spend by virtue of the fact that they are already participating in the CPC Plus program. Starting in March 2019, the collaborative will make recommendations to the Health Policy Board on a biannual optimal primary care spend target that is applicable to all payers. And I think that this is one of the areas that the collaborative is interested in, is staying active and being a resource to primary care reform moving forward. At a minimum, payers must increase their primary care spend by at least 1% from the previous calendar year to the target identified by the collaborative. Beginning in January of 2018, payers have a maximum of 5 years to achieve the primary care spend target identified by the collaborative before being assessed a penalty for failure to comply with the target. Specifically, the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Consumer and Business Services shall adopt by rule penalties to be imposed on all payers that fail to comply. This differs from the collaborative recommendations. While the recommendations say that primary care spend will be doubled from current level, which was 14.4, this language provides the collaborative with an opportunity to analyze the data from the 2017, 18, and 19 primary care spend reports, then collectively set primary care spending targets based on this data. In regards to methodology for determining primary care spending, while the collaborative recommendation does not address primary care spend report or methodology, the Senate Bill 934 work group did. Some payers have concerns about the primary care spend report methodology, and through feedback, they look forward to providing recommendations on refining the methodology and on language for updating the definition of primary care with regard specifically to behavioral health integration. The work group included the following points. The methodology for determining the primary care spend should be transparent and clear. The collaborative will make recommendations to the Oregon Health Authority and the Department of Consumer and Business Services to refine and update the methodology, including but not limited to the definition of primary care services. The definition of primary care to calculate primary care spend should include both physical and behavioral health services delivered by clinicians who are primary care clinical team members and delivering services in a primary care setting. In regards to annual reporting, the collaborative will report annually to their legislature on a status of and progress towards the primary care spend target and methods of payment. This new addition to the legislation would help simplify the role of the collaborative. In terms of national models, the legislation should be mindful of referring to national models or the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services innovation, because initiatives could change. A suggestion is to refer to the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Health Services instead of specific models such as even CPC Plus. This issue will which simply did not come up during discussions leading to the recommendations, was introduced in an effort to ensure the work taken on as a result of legislation does not end if CPC Plus ends. Next slide. There were a number of areas that we wanted to reinforce the themes in Senate Bill 934 that are consistent with the previous recommendation. First is payer participation. All payers, prominent commercial payers, prominent Medicare Advantage payers, Medicaid CCOs, and health plans contracted with Public Employees Benefits Board and Oregon Education Benefit Board must participate in increasing primary care innovation and primary care spend. This is critical to the type of to the quality of patient care. This is critical to the quality of patient care. Practices can only have one system of care. That system will align to the payment methodology, and therefore having all payers involved is critical. This is a consistent theme of the collaborative. Population served. As many populations as possible should be covered by and benefit from these efforts, and payers should be allowed to provide incentives to address the unique needs of the communities they serve, which include vulnerable populations, pediatrics, and rural Oregonians. And in terms of payer elements, payers will offer similar benefits. Payers will offer similar payment elements to all patient-centered primary care homes with a minimum threshold of members not to be limited by one age group, to be determined by the Primary Care Payment Reform Collaborative. This ensures new payment models are not limited to practices that meet minimum thresholds of Medicare members, as is the case with CPC Plus. This is a methodology that serves the entire community, not just particular segments of the community. So in summary, there is a group of underlying tenets that should be reflected in legislation. One, increased investment in primary care. Two, alignment of payment across all payers. Three, the drive towards continual improvement in care and payment aligned to that care model, including the emerging efforts to address social determinants of health. Thank you.
I would think that CCOs would be worried about underreporting for primary care. And I'm thinking in, say, a patient sees a cardiologist and really doesn't really at a certain point for 6 months or a year should only be seeing that cardiologist. That cardiologist would maybe recommend a primary care, you know, vaccination or some other things. I mean, what I'm worried about is possibly the possibility of underreporting, and I don't know enough about what, you know, how the mix would be, but there would be maybe some people being dinged it's only because of the methodology used in reporting primary care services. So, and I guess, is the process going to be open enough so that, I mean, I'd hate to see a CCO being dinged because they didn't meet a threshold, although I think, according to Steiner Hayward, that looks like everyone's getting there. But this methodology, is it going to be easy enough so that everyone across the board will need to report whether they do a primary care service or not, even though they may be a specialist?
Yeah, so Chair Monis Anderson, that's a great question. And the methodology that's used to generate the current primary care spending report is in rule. But as you recall, Dr. Fields noted that one of the recommendations of the work group from the SB 231 collaborative was that the collaborative would have the ability to make recommendations to OHA and DCBS to refine and update the methodology, including but not limited to the definition of primary care services. So I think with that recommendation from the collaborative directed at OHA, that we could, you know, look at that methodology and make sure that it is inclusive and including those types of services that you speak to.
And then, and before I lose my train of thought,
yeah.
So if for some reason the metrics isn't met or the goal isn't met, would all providers then have to take the hit, the payment reform for the whole CCO, say 50%, if they don't meet the goal, then the payment would be reduced for the entire CCO? I mean, I need to have some explanation on.
Yeah. This, Chairman Sanderson, this legislation isn't really getting at the payment to the CCO, the global payment to the CCO. You know, this is just saying that a certain percentage of payments need to be directed towards primary care physicians, so that the 12% of all payments need to go to primary care.
But what happens if they...
Yeah, I think I can help with that. I think if you want, Dr. Rickards, or I can help.
Yeah.
Two things. Second question first. The intention, actually, Madam Chair, is not that payments would be taken, pulled back from providers directly, but that the CCOs or the commercial insurers, you understand that this would apply equally to all payers, all straight commercial, all CCOs. So there's a very even approach to this. But the penalty would accrue to the organization, not to the providers who received the payments, because any payment that's going to the provider would be counted as part of it. So you wouldn't want to pull back those dollars, because the intent is to get more dollars into primary care, whether that's directly to primary care practices or towards community-based care that also qualifies under the current rubric. With regard to your other concern, I would say two things. First of all, because, as Dr. Rickards alluded to and as I just confirmed, exactly the same measurement applies to all CCOs and all commercial insurers, I think that helps reduce the risk that any one CCO is going to be unfairly penalized. The other point is that I believe, and Dr. Rickards, please correct me if I'm wrong, that the all-payer, all-claims database is part of this process of reporting, and therefore an immunization that was administered by, say, a cardiologist or a dentist, for that matter, would be picked up by that methodology, so it would be seen. But I do think we have the capacity, as Dr. Rickards also mentioned, that the Primary Care Collaborative could and should, over time, evolve the criteria, but they would apply uniformly across the board, so they'd be very even-handed, and no one CCO or commercial insurer would be unfairly impacted by differential criteria. Does that help?
Yeah, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay. Thank you.
Laura Etherton, Don Creech, and Tom Holt. Oh, no, I'll keep Tom and Peter as a second.
Sure. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on Senate Bill 934. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the Health Policy Director at the Oregon Primary Care Association, or OPCA. Our organization represents the 32 community health centers across Oregon, known as federally qualified health centers, that deliver integrated primary care, including dental and behavioral health, to over 400,000 Oregonians across the state. And health centers have a focus on vulnerable populations, and as such have a central role as part of the network with coordinated care organizations networks, and serve 1 in 4 patients on the Oregon Health Plan. OPCA supports the aims of Senate Bill 934 to increase investment in primary care and align payment to support the patient-centered primary care homes and emerging advanced models of care consistent with the recommendations from the collaborative that you've heard so much about. OPCA and several of our member health centers served on the collaborative and hope to continue serving on the collaborative as it continues, and appreciate the work of Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Bueller to sponsor this bill and move this work forward. Community health centers have been on the journey to transform care and payment for over 10 years now. This began largely, like so many primary care partners, began with transforming into patient-centered primary care homes. And then more recently, in the last 5 years, OPCA has been working intensively with the Oregon Health Authority to develop and implement alternative payment methodologies for a portion of the payment that goes to community health centers and rural health clinics. Aligning payment to support transforming care models is critical as part of Oregon's transformation. It is complex work, and it's important to get it right, approach it thoughtfully and carefully, know that we probably won't get it perfect, and to be able to have it be an iterative process. As you've heard, the collaborative used the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services comprehensive Primary Care Plus payment model to inform its recommendations for a statewide payment framework that would be consistent with CPC Plus without being that sort of one-size-fits-all, to offer that flexibility within the models to approach the different populations. I also want to just highlight a couple of the sort of challenges with CPC Plus that make this work really important. As you've heard, CPC Plus is only open to some types of providers, specifically those that are paid on the Medicare fee schedule. That means pediatric practices, rural health clinics, and federally qualified health centers or community health centers are not able to participate, even though that many of these practices are in fact at the forefront of care transformation. Secondly, because CPC Plus is a national model really designed for a subset of patients and providers, it may not necessarily meet the behavioral and medical and social needs of diverse populations. So that flexibility to have for payers to be able to address those needs is very important. Again, that sort of one-size-fits-all piece. And then finally, the CPC Plus model includes a set of existing quality metrics really for that Medicare population that don't necessarily align with the CCO metrics or the work that will be coming out of the 440 committee. So recognizing these challenges, we were supportive of the collaborative's recommendations to develop a framework with CPC Plus as a guide, but not a one-size-fits-all, and to take steps to ensure applicability for all populations and providers moving forward. This really thoughtful approach, we think, will foster payment models that have common elements while giving payers flexibility to ensure payments support care models that meet the needs of the population served, such as, for example, homeless patients or rural communities or pediatrics. Such an approach will be especially key for the Medicaid population and Oregon's focus on care integration and addressing the social determinants of health. We understand there are amendments in the works. The bill will be changing quite a bit as we go forward, and think that will be important to do to make sure this aligns well with the collaborative's recommendations, and we look forward to being part of those ongoing conversations. Again, thank you. I want to offer appreciation for Senator Steiner-Hayward's work on this bill and the collaborative's work to move this forward, and we look forward to our continued involvement both in the collaborative and in this body to move this work forward. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Dawn Creech. I'm Program Manager of Medical Home Delivery and Innovation. I'm here today on behalf of the Children's Health Alliance, which is an association that includes more than 100 private practice pediatricians. Our providers care for approximately 140,000 children and their families, which is why none of our pediatricians were able to be here today. However, I can tell you that every one of them supports Senate Bill 934. Over the last 13 years of my career, I've had the opportunity to work closely with well over 100 primary care practices. And what is most striking to me is that every single one of them wants to provide the best possible care for their patients. And this is despite the financial disincentives to do so. Every time primary care practices do the right thing by hiring care coordinators, behavioral health clinicians, nutritionists, or even staying open late on evenings and weekends, other parts of the healthcare system benefit. In Oregon, we see reduced ER visits and hospitalizations, fewer visits to specialists. You've already heard a lot about the Portland State University study that showed the $240 million saved over just 3 years and the 13-to-1 ROI for dollars that are invested in primary care. And so I think we're in a unique position where the evidence is pretty clear about what we need to do to build a strong primary care infrastructure that benefits the entire healthcare system. However, we know now that in Oregon, approximately 90% of our medical expenditures are on sick care, and that excludes the cost of pharmaceuticals. And I keep thinking to myself, how are we ever going to transform our healthcare system if we continue to direct nearly 90% of our medical spending to treating patients once they are already sick? In pediatrics, we have a unique opportunity for preventive care with nearly every child and family in Oregon. We can impact the lifelong health trajectory of children and at the same time provide support and education for families. However, team-based care and transforming practices takes considerable investment, often with little or no return to the physician practices that are shouldering those costs. I really honestly believe that now is the time to move our healthcare dollars upstream so that we can focus on prevention instead of paying so heavily for sick care. We also know that there is significant variation in how much insurers in Oregon are dedicating to primary care services from the spend report that was referenced earlier. Some are doing the right thing while others are not contributing their fair share in supporting the primary care infrastructure. I have been fortunate enough to also participate in the Primary Care Payment Reform Collaborative over this last year. Prominent insurers, provider groups sat around a table and had really meaningful discussions about how to support primary care in Oregon. And everyone agreed that we need increased investment to support primary care and that all insurers should contribute their fair share. I can tell you that these conversations were not easy ones, but it was a huge accomplishment to come to consensus, and we are thrilled to see the recommendations in Senate Bill 934 and are grateful for Senator Steiner Hayward in putting that forward. On behalf of more than 100 pediatricians in the Children's Health Alliance, we strongly support SB 934, which will truly help move our healthcare dollars upstream and prevent costly sick care, ultimately giving providers the resources they need to take the best possible care of children and families. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you very much. Tom Holt, Peter McGarry.
Good afternoon, Senator Montez Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter McGarry. I'm the Vice President of Provider Network for Pacific Source Health Plans. Pacific Source is an independent, not-for-profit health plan that serves over 300,000 members in Oregon, Idaho, and Montana. We're a Medicare Advantage plan, a commercial plan, and we serve Medicaid members as well. We are the CCO in two regions in the state of Oregon, the Central Oregon region and the Columbia Gorge region. I want to begin by just saying thanks for the opportunity to provide some testimony. We've given written testimony, and we're supplementing it with some verbal testimony. I want to thank Senator Steiner Hayward for her leadership on the topic, and it's an awesome topic because there is no better way for primary care. There's no better way for the triple aim to be attained than by investment in robust primary care that can impact the triple aim, the cost of care, the quality of care, and the patient experience of care. And Pacific Source has been working in this space for as long as I've been with the organization, which is 8 years. We are part of the CPC Plus program that Medicare recently initiated for not just our Medicare members, but our commercial members and our Medicaid members. We've been part of prior iterations of payers coming together around a medical home concept, the high-value patient-centered medical home, which existed in 2010 and 11. We have our own medical homes that we've developed with some provider partners throughout the state. And we grant fund. We invest in primary care to the tune of $600,000 a year by asking primary care providers mostly to give innovative ideas to us. We grant fund, and that goes to enhance things like care coordination within a primary care setting, integrating physical and physical health care with behavioral health care, with pharmacy care, with pain management care, tackling disease states like pediatric obesity and diabetes, and some of the organizations that have been recipients of the program are represented in this room right now. The beauty of those multiple approaches in those last 8 years has been one common theme, is that they bring out the providers that have the initiative, the capability, the desire, the strategic leadership, and the guts to want to say, I want to do primary care better, and we're going to commit our organization's resources and capacities to doing that. But that isn't the case for all primary care. For every provider that says, I want to be part of something better, there are providers that don't really want to initiate around the triple aim. And you have the, just like all health plans and payers are not created equal, so too is all primary care not created equal. And the beauty of programs like CPC Plus are it really attracts those providers that want to be part of the change. And they're the ones that have to do the work, but they get the benefits from that program as well. And that's why we are happy and have been happy to be part of those kinds of programs. But within the structure of Senate Bill 934, we do have some concerns. And some of those concerns are in the area of affordability and some of the unintended consequences, and some of it is in the detail or some of the lack of detail. So I'm going to go over those two categories, and I'm happy to field any questions you might have throughout. First, by structuring a mandate around primary care spend as a percentage of overall cost of care, I think there's some unintended consequences with what you might not expect. There could be a flu outbreak that sort of increases overall cost of care, or there could be a lot of new drugs that hit the market that increase trend for pharmacy spend to a great extent. And those things would impact that number, that percentage that would be mandated to be provided by the health plans. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I think it's an unknown. It's an unintended consequence, and it could have impacts on the overall cost of care. Without a commensurate reduction in the cost of care that would go along with the mandate to pay a certain amount for primary care, you have a situation that could have the unintended consequence of increasing overall cost of care, because there's no reduction in hospital care, pharmacy care, specialty care, any other segment of the healthcare continuum. And what would be the impacts of that? I'm not sure. But I feel like there could be an overall increase to the cost of care, which would, as a commercial insurer, lead to increasing rates for those individuals that want to buy coverage, and it could lead to employers and individuals having to eliminate coverage or reduce the amount of coverage. Lastly, I feel like this is a solution that's not exactly a perfect match with the problem. This is about taking a percentage and saying care, cost of care for primary care has to be exactly at that percentage, or you have to pay a penalty, or you have to get to that level. But it feels like a more targeted approach might be to mandate plans to participate in CPC Plus. That would encourage providers to want to be part of the program that aren't right now. That would encourage payers to want to be part of the CPC Plus program. Some aren't right now. And could be something that really galvanizes all entities, the coverage and the delivery system, around one common mode that everybody agrees is a good way for primary care to get the investments that they need. Secondly, and in the details or the lack of details, when I've read the legislation, there's not a lot of detail that says what counts in as primary care. Senator, you brought up the cardiology example. I was thinking about some other ones like endocrinology, where diabetes is sometimes cared for by primary care, but sometimes by specialists that are in some of the specialty areas like endocrine medicine. What about urgent care services? I think a lot of those providers think of themselves as providing primary care. I know OBGYNs do for the 9 months or however long patients are under their care. They're providing a lot of the primary care. I know naturopaths and chiropractors that think they provide primary care. And I feel like some of the detail and the lack of clarity there gives us some concern. In addition, what counts as cost within primary care? I mentioned the grant funding, the grant investing that we do with primary care providers. I don't know if those dollars would count as spend or investment in primary care, although I think it's very effective. There's other things like surpluses. When we have budget models and we have amounts of dollars that we pay as bonuses to providers because of good quality and good cost management, I don't know if those bonuses get counted as primary care payments or not. I don't see some of that detail in the model. And lastly, we do make PMPM, per member per month, payments to invest in some of our provider partners doing good jobs with care management, outreach for patient care for those patients that don't want to come in, and really doing a good job of tracking disease states amongst their population. I don't know if those things count either. Lastly, and in conclusion, we love this topic because we've done a lot in the primary care space and investing in it, but we're not sure that some of the lack of details and some of the lack of targeting this towards a care model in the primary care space that could attract people in all parts of the continuum make us have some concerns around the legislation.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you. Thank you for those detailed comments. I really appreciate it. I wonder if I could ask you just a couple quick questions and address a couple of your concerns.
Sure.
With regard to the issue around something like a flu epidemic or increased price of pharmaceuticals, and by the way, there's a bill for that, 793, which is making some progress, thanks to my good work of my colleague, Senator Cruz. I would imagine that those would probably affect all insurers pretty equally, right? I mean, there might be some variation if there was a drug that was on formulary for one insurer and not for others, but if there's a flu epidemic, the chances are pretty good it wouldn't hit any one insurance company disproportionately from any other, right?
I don't know. Clinician background is not sort of where I come from, but I would imagine that if you had a pandemic in the arena of a flu, you would probably have some commonality amongst communities.
Yeah, so I appreciate your concerns, but I think many of the, from my perspective at least, many of the examples you raise would probably affect the vast majority of CCOs and commercial insurers pretty equally. So I think that there would probably be some consideration. With regard to the concerns that you had about what's included and what's not included, I hope you've had an opportunity to look at the criteria that were laid out by the health authority. I think many of the things that you mentioned are, in fact, included in those criteria.
Okay.
The grants probably are included. The PMPMs are certainly included. The whole point of having it aligned with the metrics and scoring is so that all of those things are exactly the kinds of things you're talking about. And I think the point that Dr. Rickards made about the collaborative's recommendation that they be able to work on revising the criteria as they go along would be an opportunity for those things to be addressed should it be discovered that there was something substantive missing.
Yeah, I would hope that both Pacific Source and other health plans would have such an opportunity to say, hey, there are investments that we make maybe in atypical ways or maybe through non-traditional means that probably are worthy of consideration.
Well, I don't want to speak for the health authority, but my sense is overall they've been pretty receptive, and I know Pacific Source participated in the collaborative, so I would hope that that would continue.
Yeah.
And I think your concern about the increased costs, I'm struck by the PSU report that talked about the $240 million in savings that were accrued by the investments in the patient-centered primary care homes, and I would believe, suggest certainly strongly, that many of those came from decreasing costs in subspecialty care, in hospital care.
Yeah.
We know, for example, that when you have robust investment in case management after hospitalization, that you avoid rehospitalizations or you avoid hospitalizations in the first place for ambulatory sensitive conditions. So I certainly don't think anybody intends for this to increase the overall cost. The intention is to front load, if you will, the system to help avoid those avoidable costs down the road. It's not perfect, but I think these are the kinds of concerns that have been raised for a long time and that have ultimately, in various contexts, been shown to be less concerning than one might fear they would be.
Yeah, I'm sorry to take up too much time. My colleague is waiting here. However, the numbers that were presented in terms of savings and the success of the model were nothing short of spectacular. Nationally, there have been some mixed results around return on investment around medical home, and I'm just citing it as an unknown. It could be that those kinds of savings are replicated and what would result from moving in this direction. I'm just not 100% certain.
And I appreciate your concern. I don't want to belabor the point, but I would point out that Oregon's patient-centered primary care home model is very different from the rest of the countries. The NCQA standard for patient-centered primary care home is really not what I personally or pretty much anybody else who does primary care in the state thinks is really a patient-centered primary care home. It's more about doctors and practices than about patients.
Yeah.
And so the PSU study really just evaluated the Oregon model, and we're talking about continuing to invest in the Oregon model. So I would have a little more confidence that the results are replicable, but I appreciate your concern.
I think that's
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Miles Anderson, members of the committee, Tom Holt for Cambia Health Solutions. I'd like to just spend a minute talking about what we have been doing in our journey in encouraging alignment of incentives to get to, I think, the place there's consensus of get away from the fee-for-service model and rewarding providers for outcomes, and for helping manage at a more population health basis so that we can have a more sustainable system. I think we all believe that the system as it exists today is badly broken, and we need to figure out better ways of doing things. We've been on quite a journey around primary care and encouraging primary care home approaches and population approaches. We were one of a handful of payers who participated in CPCI in this state, and frankly, had we not come in, they wouldn't have been able to do it here because of the numbers of people that we serve. We learned a lot from that. We examined CPC Plus carefully and chose not to, in large part because we were already well down the runway on other methodologies that have borne fruit already. Now, my actuarial friends would say that a couple of years does not really make a sustainable trend yet, but we see a lot of promise. And the approach that we've been taking so far in all of our operating states, we operate health plans in four states, has been primarily a total cost of care model. And what that means is that we get to agreement with mostly larger clinics because the smaller clinics simply don't have the infrastructure yet, and we're working on that. But the idea is that we come to agreement around, you know, what are the important metrics that we would like to see move? And that's where the Senate Bill 440 work is so important here. And we get to that agreement, and then we say, okay, you hit these targets on outcomes, quality piece, and then we also hit some cost targets, and then there's rewards at the end. And what we have seen fairly consistently and we're very excited about is that we're seeing things like ER visits down, hospital readmits down, other common metrics that I think most folks here would probably agree are some of the very important ones, you know, all mostly heading in the right direction. And, oh, by the way, costs down a bit too. So it's sort of a win-win-win all the way around. Now, it is more challenging, we find, with smaller practices because, you know, physicians like my physician, who's a one-doc practice, it's him and a nurse and someone who handles the billing and appointments, you know, he doesn't have a data person sitting out back. And so we've been working on some pilot projects in one of our other states of what can we do to provide infrastructure to help small practices work together towards similar goals. And it's early days. But my point here really is that innovation has many flavors. You know, for some here, CPC Plus looked like a great model. We were not sold on it because we had other things that were in flight, but we also had some hard learnings out of CPCI where, you know, it did not return the results that we had hoped. So we're, you know, looking at a lot of different things. And it's, you know, we look across nationally at studies and experience of our other health plan colleagues in other regions. And frankly, we don't think anybody really knows for certain the answer yet. And so it's way too soon to say that one size or two sizes or three sizes fit all. And that's where we start to have concerns with the legislative approach here. It's not really to us about the percentage of dollars that go into primary care. It's what do the primary care clinics do and what kind of results do they get for our members? Are they helping our members stay healthier, not having just sick care, as one of the prior witnesses mentioned? We agree with that, that, you know, we don't want to just be paying for people to have sick care. We want to keep people you know, in better shape so that they can be at their jobs, be with their families, and whatever. So having a set percentage is a problem. Others have mentioned, but I'll just touch on here, you know, this question about what really counts. You know, if a cardiologist is essentially primary care for someone, does that count? Does a pulmonologist managing an asthmatic, does that count? What happens when there's an epidemic and hospital costs go way up for a very good reason? Does it, you know, are we writing a check at the end of the year because we didn't hit a percentage? We don't know. I think more broadly, though, this is, you know, when we try to mandate a particular approach, what we do is we send it down a compliance track. and away from an innovation track. And we need more innovation in healthcare, as we do think the system needs a lot more work. We are very supportive of the Senate Bill 231 Collaborative. One of our lead people on our total cost of care arrangements has been a participant. We think it's been a terrific forum for sharing information and best practices, which was our understanding of what that group was going to do. It distresses us somewhat to hear it described now as being a potential regulatory body. I think it defeats the purpose and gets in the way of us moving forward. You know, I really appreciate that, Senator Steiner Hayward, you keep bringing this issue of where are we on this journey in front of us. So I think it's really important to keep in front of us, you know, where are we in truly moving away from fee-for-service and rewarding people for doing the right things. But we respectfully disagree with the course described in the bill as written or conceptually described. On what the amendments might be, but you know, we would love to continue participating and updating all of you on our journey and where all this is and continuing to collaborate with our provider partners. You know, we hope that one day, not too far down the road, that broadly payers and providers will figure out, you know, the right variety of ways that move the ball forward.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that wants to speak? This is your last chance. No. Great. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 934 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 808.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 808, brought to you by Senators Boquist and Beyer and Representatives Buehler and Parrish. The bill requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules specifying health screening testing for newborns based on national guidelines, establishes a review committee on health screen testing for newborns, and it tasks the committee to setting proposed recommendations for health screen testing for newborns in Oregon. Sunsets committee on December 31st. There is a dash one amendment posted on OLIS, and testimony is also available on OLIS.
Okay, Jennifer Knapp, Tammy Wilson, and Todd Waddell.
Or Waddell.
Dear Senator, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the Senate Health Care Committee, my name is Jennifer Knapp, and I'm Director of Adrenal Insufficiency United, and I'm here representing our members with ALD. I'm also the Oregon Volunteer State Ambassador for the National Organization for Rare Disorders, and in that role, I'm speaking for all Oregonians affected by rare disease. I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 808. When my daughter was born in 1995, her life-threatening genetic condition was not on the newborn screening panel. It was the experience of our pediatrician that saved her life. Soon after her birth, our pediatrician suspected my daughter's condition due to the two other babies he had treated it with in his practice. My now 21-year-old daughter is still living with that life-threatening condition, but only because we knew to seek treatment. Had our pediatrician not been practicing long enough to see other babies with my daughter's condition, she could have died within the first few weeks of her life. I have some testimony to read from others in our group. This little girl is named Mara, and her parents are Amber and Eric Monaghan. They live in Eugene, Oregon. So this story is about Mara. Soon after her birth by Frank Breach, our daughter Mara started showing signs of a rare lysosomal disease called MPS. This disease is progressive and begins causing irreversible damage immediately upon birth and likely prior to birth. Mara came home from the hospital with a cold and suffered from a perpetually runny nose. She was constantly projectile vomiting and had breast milk jaundice for 12 weeks. She also started to develop a bump on her back. All of these symptoms together were extremely unusual for a newborn. For us, they were especially different and concerning because Mara's 15-month-old brother had none of those issues. At Mara's third-month, six-month, and nine-month well checks appointments, her parents brought up the concerns about her many symptoms and the bumps on her back. Finally, an x-ray was done and showed some deformity of her spine, which the pediatrician said was in within normal limits. Even with Mara's other symptoms and the parents' persistent concerns, they were only referred to a specialist because they insisted. Because the disease is so rare, pediatricians do not generally see children with this with these disorders in medical school residency or fellowship. The specialist that finally saw Mara was from another country and had seen MPS in that country. He was able to make the connection. So Mara was 15 months old before her diagnosis. Babies with MPS can begin treatment with enzyme replacement therapies at 3 weeks of age, followed by bone marrow transplants as early as 3 months of age, but only if the diagnosis is timely. Unfortunately, without a family history, babies are not diagnosed in time to start these therapies. Senate Bill 808, which will require testing for MPS and other conditions added to the RUSP, will allow families to begin treatment for their child at a much younger age, sparing them permanent damage. Mara began her therapy on the day before her first birthday and received her bone marrow transplant at 13 months old. Even though the parents were extremely fortunate that there was treatment available, it was too late to stop some of the progression of the disease and prevent some of the damage to Mara's body. She has visual impairment, hearing loss, large adenoids, many other conditions and results because of that. The average age of diagnosis without newborn screening is 3 to 5 years, but a bone marrow transplant is only an option for children diagnosed before age 2. However, with Mara, progression of the disease has already done a great deal of damage by then. Most children undiagnosed at 1 year of age are already beginning to show a cognitive delay. The severity of the disease varies in each child, but early diagnosis and treatment can reduce and eliminate the symptoms. Newborn screening will allow other babies with Mara's condition and other conditions added to the RUSP to receive adequate care, resulting in fewer medical needs, and save families from the devastation of never finding the right diagnosis until it's too late for their child. So Amber and Eric Mongan asked for your support in Senate Bill 808. And I do have another testimony, but I think I'll let the other families that are here go first.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Todd Waddell. I live in Clackamas County. I'll be here to speak in support of improving newborn screening in Oregon. My son, Ethan, suffers from a rare disease called Hurler syndrome, similar to the Mongan's girl. MPS1 Hurler's is a genetic disorder in which the body is unable to produce an enzyme that removes a naturally occurring waste product from the cells. Because of the missing enzyme, the waste builds up in every cell of the body so that Hurler's impacts every organ and every part of the body. Left untreated, children with Hurler's typically die by age 8 in a blind and vegetative state. Hurler's is very rare. Most doctors will never encounter a Hurler's patient in their practice or in their medical group's practice. As a result, although the early symptoms can be easy to see, it can be very difficult to get an accurate diagnosis. Ethan started showing symptoms about a month after birth. Every day, for hours at a time, he would cry and scream uncontrollably as the disease damaged his central nervous system. At 6 months old, Ethan was diagnosed with a malformation of his chest cavity, the first of many orthopedic manifestations he would develop. At 9 months old, Ethan was diagnosed with a spinal kyphosis, an outward curvature of the spine, and with an inguinal hernia in his groin. We would get occasional phone calls from our pediatrician saying that he was researching Ethan's condition. His dedication led to a 3-day stay at OHSU to run a full series of tests. One week before Ethan's first birthday, we received a diagnosis. We were extremely lucky, as most babies with the disease are not diagnosed until 3 to 5 years of age, after the disease has caused significant damage. Hurler's is an incurable disease. However, we are fortunate there are some treatments available to slow its effects. Within a week after starting enzyme replacement therapy, Ethan's symptoms improved. The most effective treatment for Hurler's is a bone marrow transplant. Transplant allows the body to start producing the missing enzyme itself, which is the only way to get the enzyme into the brain and slow the neurological degeneration caused by the disease. The neurological and physiological impact of Hurler's is so severe that standard medical protocol dictates that to be approved for transplant, the child must be younger than 36 months old. After this time, it is considered that the impact of the disease is so great that the cost and risk of transplant are no longer outweighed by the benefits. Even a few months' difference in diagnosis and treatment make a significant difference in the rest of that child's life. Ethan had his bone marrow transplant in October 2009 at 15 months old. We watched that transplant slowly fail over the following year and a half. Ethan had his second bone marrow transplant at 33 months old. That transplant has successfully slowed the course of the disease. Ethan's successful transplant occurred comparatively late, and we will always live with the impact of that delay. Developmentally and emotionally, Ethan is noticeably more delayed than Hurler children who were transplanted sooner. Until he was 5 years old, Ethan's spoken vocabulary was about 50 words. He is 8 and a half now, but his developmental age is 4 or 5. He is in a fully self-contained special education classroom in North Clackamas Schools. Meanwhile, other Hurler children are in mainstream classrooms because they received effective treatment earlier. This legislation means Oregon children will get earlier diagnosis and treatment, which will lead to lower medical costs, significantly better quality of life, and fundamentally, it will save lives. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Tammy Wilson. This is my son, Michael Wilson, age 6. Our family, I am a mother of 6, 4 biological, and 2 that I have fostered, one in which I adopted. The last 7 years, my family has literally spent surviving in the world of rare disease. My 2 youngest biological children were diagnosed with a rare, brutal, and fatal disease called Krebs disease. It is a leukodystrophy that attacks the nervous system. The nervous system stops with the brain. It basically stops communicating with the brain and literally starts shutting down everything possible. Some of the effects, it jumped up here. I choose to read from my words, otherwise I'll sit here and sob the whole story. It's basically, my son stopped losing, he was losing his body functions very quickly and very aggressively. Sometimes very quick and aggressively, but slowly. I am one of many mothers in this disease who have seen the beginning and the end of this disease both on the affected child side and the treated child side. Most, if not all, parents see the affected side of this disease. They watch their child from diagnosis, actually from the very beginning of symptoms. It's usually not till 3 to 5 months later that they receive a diagnosis. To the very last second that they say goodbye to their dying child. My son Marshall earned his angel wings on March 5th, 2016. He was diagnosed with this horrible disease and literally took 6 years to degenerate his body. Daily, he had lost his hearing, he had lost his eyesight. He was having an average of 12 to 40 seizures a day, irritability, nerve pain, rigidness, spasms, the inability to feed by mouth, the inability to stand, to sit, the loss of head control, the inability to walk, and so much more. The list goes on. This disease took all of this from him within less than 6 months. And children that start progressing at earlier than 6 months usually have a life expectancy of 18 to 24 months. This disease traveled through my son like a hurricane, like attacking with a vengeance with no remorse. A war my son, or anyone else for that matter, could not defeat. My son died in the ER waiting room up at Dornbecker, 4 hours away from me. And the best thing about his life is the care, love, and quality of life that was given to him through the family, caretakers, specialists, and prayer warriors from all over the world. On September 25th, Marshall's youngest brother, which is with us today, Michael Wilson, was born, and on December 19th of 2010, he received the exact same diagnosis. Can you imagine receiving this? Can you imagine receiving a diagnosis for 2 of your children that they were going to die? Though Michael was not screened at birth, he was tested for the disease because of his brother. Marshall saved his brother's life. My son saved his baby brother's life. On February 10, 2011, Michael received a life-saving cord blood transplant. Michael is now 6 years old and in a regular curriculum type kindergarten classroom and actually advancing into first grade earlier than expected. The normal kindergarten classroom He runs and plays with the children in the classroom. He has no seizures. He can see the clear blue skies, and he can hear his mother say, "I love you," which is something my son, Marshall, had lost. Michael was diagnosed with a terminal disease, and as of today, he is crab A free. He shows no signs of disease. He visits annually between the crab A specialist and the transplant doctor to ensure that this transplant has been successful. And each year that we move further from the transplant, the better off he is. I've never asked why. Why us? Why Marshall? I do believe we were set for a mission. He saved his brother's life. He gave hope where the disease could not. I do, however, ask, why didn't Marshall get the same opportunity? Why didn't Marshall get the same opportunity to test for the same disease? Why didn't he have the same timeline to save his life? Why didn't he get the same life-saving treatment? Is it because he didn't have a sibling with the same disease, so that he could be tested in time? Is it because mankind neglected to offer a test that is readily available but not offered or implemented? Marshall saved his brother's life, not newborn screening. Who saved Marshall's life? What about Marshall? What about other Krabbe children? What about other rare disease children? There is a life-saving test and treatment for most, if not for a good portion of rare disease. I didn't have to bury my son. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We have the Dash 1 amendments, and it replaces the bill. And Jennifer, can you explain, or Oliver, do you want to explain, or Jennifer, how the Dash 1s came to be?
Yes, I can talk to that. Dean Sewer and I, who were working on the bill together, have been talking with people with the Newborn Screening Laboratory and OHA and had some good conversations around that. And there were some concerns about the time frame. And so what the amendment does is add in, if there is not an FDA-approved test, that instead of 2 years from adding to the RUSP, it would be 2 years from the FDA-approved test coming out, or giving them a three-year deadline if they need to do a lab-developed test.
So basically, with respect to newborn screening, the authority, or Oregon Health Authority, may conduct tests for conditions listed on the most recent edition of the recommended uniform screening panel. And then we'll adopt rules specifying the tests, and it goes, like you said, no later than 2 years after the date. Okay, and then we can call the lab up. But does anyone have questions on the dash?
Yes, I have a question. This does have a test. And maybe it's a better question, better addressed at the lab.
This does have a test sponsor list.
What keeps them, given that this is permissive language, right, and not requiring language, what keeps them from doing it? Why would they not be allowed under current statute to do it, should they so choose?
With the language being permissive, we were looking at this as that they would be required to do this within the 2 years. So
the authority
and
shall.
I know it says may, so that.
Well, in the section line six, it says shall specify that a person providing, but then it goes on. But why don't we
may conduct tests?
Yeah, but may conduct tests. So
yeah.
We just wanted to make sure that we were clear on that.
I'll clarify that.
If I could say too that there is California recently passed legislation very similar to this, and it passed unanimously, and Florida has passed out of both the House and Senate committees, same type of legislation. So.
Any questions for this panel?
No, we may need to find out from LC. They keep going back and forth as to which is mandatory, which is permissive, may and shall. We've had that over the years. So.
Okay. We can have that. Okay. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. It's heart-rending to hear your stories. Okay. John Fontana.
Good afternoon. I'm John Fontana, and I'm the director of the Public Health Laboratory. Thank you, Chair Mons Anderson, and the members of the committee. The amendments that came in this morning kind of changed our testimony, because it seems that between the conversations we had with the different organizations, that they've changed them so that the statute's pointing to the right statute, and it also gives us a little more play in how we're going to adopt these tests once they get on the RUSP. So I've decided not to read my testimony, if that's okay with you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about how we would do this, how we would bring these tests on. And we do have a process at the laboratory where once something gets on the RUSP, we look at
the
Recommended Uniform Screening Panel, which is it's a national committee at Health and Human Services that comes up with these recommendations based on extensive work that they do to see the effectiveness of the test. Effectiveness of the test for treatment, of the disorder for treatment, and having a valid test available. So in the case of the current items on the RUSP, the FDA just approved four of the lysosomal storage disorders, MPS1, Pompe, and the Krabbe and Fabry disease. So we are pursuing getting the equipment, figuring out how we're going to implement it in our laboratory, which includes processing the specimens, informing our clients, and then dealing with the process that our follow-up physicians would deal with, because they have to know what they're looking at if we bring on a new test, and they have to have a path to treatment and taking care of the children. So it's a fairly complicated process, but we are going to look into that, and we want to do it through an ad hoc committee where we have the players from the foundations that come in, our consultants at OHSU, and the laboratory staff weighing in on what it's going to take to do that, and then we will go ahead with this. And I think we can do that in the period outlined in this bill.
Great.
Madam Chair, maybe I'll repeat, if I could, Mr. Fontana, the question that I asked the previous panel. If I'm reading the language of the -1 amendment correctly, it's just giving the opportunity to add screening for the new conditions that are added on the RUSP, as you're talking about how it would be done if it were to be done, right?
Correct.
So what in current statute keeps you from doing that now? If anything, I want to make sure these diseases are addressed, but I also don't want to add unnecessary statutory language.
Well, what keeps us from doing it now is that we generally don't adopt something if it doesn't have an FDA approved test. So that's just come out in February of 2017. Otherwise, we have to do a laboratory developed test.
So there are tests that could end up on the RUSP that don't actually have it FDA approved?
They won't have it FDA approved.
So they're willing to add things onto that overall recommended uniform screening one that are not.
That's
don't
correct.
Have
In fact, XALD does not have an FDA approved test today.
And so by passing this, though, it would give you the opportunity to do that
through a laboratory developed test.
And you would have to weigh if the cost, I guess. I think that's probably why it's permissive, correct?
Well, the cost is part of it, but the other thing is having the capability of bringing in instruments so that you can do the test.
Yeah.
And I think most of the states that are doing it, New York was the first state to do XALD, and they're a fairly large laboratory with a lot of resources, particularly in their research arm of the newborn screening program. So we don't have that capacity yet in the Northwest Regional Program.
So evidently California passed legislation very similar to this. Of course, they're bigger, so we could at least maybe they would develop the test, then and it would get approved, and then it would be easy for us.
well, for XALD, we're working with a company to bring it onto our panel through the tandem mass spectrometry instruments that we have. And so we're hoping that will be done sooner than later. We're actually piloting this new test kit they have so we can bring it into our process where we, you know, have instruments that we're using and the format that we're using for testing all the specimens we get. So we're hoping we can get that moving along, but it has not been FDA approved yet.
Madam Chair? Mm-hmm. As a matter of mostly of academic curiosity, but some pragmatic curiosity, how do you then determine the sensitivity and specificity of the test to ensure that you're actually making the diagnosis when it exists and not ending up with false positives?
That's the challenge that we have. And I think that when you're working with instrument manufacturers, then you want to have some targets that are, for the tandem mass spectrometry, you want to have targets that you know are linked to that particular disorder. And in this case, it's heavy fatty acid chains. And
right.
So you target those, and then you basically tune your instruments so that you know that you're looking at that particular fatty acid, and then you go from there. You have to, it requires a significant amount of testing.
Yeah.
Can I give you an example? For instance, with skid testing back in 2010, it was approved, and that was largely because the Modell Foundation gave, I think, a couple million dollars to the CDC. And CDC was developing a test. The Wisconsin Laboratory in Massachusetts were developing a test. So in Connecticut, we were charged by the legislature to do skid testing in 2011. And we were supposed to have it done in 5 months. It was supposed to be done by October 1st. And it was very difficult for us to do that. We had to decide on which of the three tests that were available. We had to get equipment. We had to hire people. It was very complicated. And what happened during our validation step, which included 5,000 sequential specimens, was that we found a child born after the first week of October that had SCID. And while we're doing our validation, we don't know if that's a true SCID child. So we have to take the specimen up to the New England program, which were colleagues of ours, and we got the test done. It was a true SCID. We got the kid within 3 or 4 days up to Children's Hospital in Massachusetts for evaluation for stem cell therapy. But it was very difficult for us to do that in that time period. And the problem with that is that if you have a child that has a disorder, once you say you have to be testing for it, we're responsible for that. So it is our liability, and I think that's why we really want to be cautious about how we bring these new tests on.
That's my concern as well. I am very sympathetic to the concerns raised by the advocates, but I'm also concerned about the science.
So the may be appropriate.
Maybe, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's why.
Thank you, Mr. Fontana.
Thank you.
Any other questions? That is all that we have for this bill, so I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 808, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 52.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 52 is brought to you by the Oregon Health Authority. The bill received a public hearing on February 16th. The bill directs the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules for ambulance services and emergency medical service providers to report patient encounter data to an EMS data management system. It specifies the types of patient outcome data to be reported, requires patient outcome data as entered by hospitals into the registry to be made available to the ambulance and emergency service providers, and directs OHA to determine by rulemaking the method by which data are available, how it may be used. There's a -1 amendment. It removes reference to EMS providers, allows non-transporting pre-hospital providers report patient data to the EMS system, requires OHA to issue an annual report based on the data that is collected, and would permit OHA to waive reporting requirements if an ambulance service provider is unable to comply with requirements. There is a no revenue impact statement, and there's a minimal fiscal impact statement on all this. Committee has the necessary paperwork.
Pardon?
He was saying -1, so that
were no, I thought it was the -3.
Apologize. Correction. It's the -3.
Okay. I want to make sure I'm on the same bill.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I have the dash threes, and it's right. And I think OHA and the association and
everybody's
and
good.
One ambulance good. Is
They're
fine.
They're all nodding yes.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 52.
Senator Cruz moves the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 52. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? They are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 52 as amended by the dash three amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 52 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Breyer.
Yes.
Senator
Cohn.
Excuse.
Senator
Steiner.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye. And let's see, was this a committee bill, or who was the sponsor of the bill? I need to...
It's a committee bill.
It's a committee bill. Okay, so...
Well, that's actually from the governor, so...
Yeah. Okay. Senator Beyer, do you mind carrying that bill?
Sure.
Okay. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 52 and open a... Work session on Senate Bill 964. Oliver?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 964, brought to you by the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. The bill received a public hearing on March 16th. The bill would allow hospitals in Oregon to grant hospital privileges to physician assistants to provide patient care. There is a dash one amendment, which would also allow hospitals to suspend, terminate, or refuse privileges of a nurse practitioner or physician assistant. There are impact statements on OLIS. There's no revenue impact, no physical impact.
And congratulations, Oliver. You got the amendment right that time.
Okay. Oh,
break, my man.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 964.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 964. And as I understand it, the hospitals and the PAs are fine with
Everybody's
it.
Good.
They've got their thumbs up. Yep. And. So is there any discussion on the dash ones? Any opposition? They are adopted into Senate Bill 964.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 964 as amended by the dash one amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 964 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Meyer.
Yes.
Senator Hill.
Excuse.
Senator Steiner.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye. I'll carry the bill and I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 964 and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 786. Oliver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 786, which received a public hearing on March 30th. The bill defines the use of telehealth and requires, there's a dash three, which is basically it is the gut and stuff, and it would allow dental providers licensed by the Oregon Board of Dentistry to use telehealth if appropriate and within a provider's scope of practice. There's a no revenue impact statement, and there's a minimal fiscal impact. Statements are posted on OLIS.
And
Madam Chair, I move the dash three amendment into Senate Bill 786.
Senator Cruz moves the dash three amendments into Senate Bill 786. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? And just to let everyone know, there is no opposition to this, and it's my understanding that the Dental Association was okay with it. Okay.
Everybody's good.
Any opposition? Okay, they are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 786 as amended by the dash three amendment to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 786 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, just one comment because telehealth has been your passion for so many years, I would suggest you carry.
Well, I thought it was a dental bill. I thought that maybe
Gerard. He's retired.
I know he's retired. Okay, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Beyer.
Yes.
Senator
Hill. Excuse.
Senator Steiner
Hayward.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Yes.
Chair Monson.
Aye. Motion carries. And I would still like to ask Senator Gerard if he would like to carry it. If he does not, I will.
Does it have to do with Ospreys and all?
Okay, right. I will close the work session on 786 and I'll open a work session on. Are we doing this one?
You want to carry it over next week? Let's go.
That's right. We have an amendment on 485. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 485, and let's have Courtney and Craig. Is it Craig?
Oliver.
Oh, the other Oliver. Okay.
Mini Oliver.
Good evening, Chair. Thank you for taking some time to hear us out today. I just wanted to say that the OMA and my name is Oliver Alexander. The OMA and Senator Pruzanski's office, including myself from Orchid Health, we've worked together to come up with a few amendments to the bill that works for both of us, and so we are pleased to read the new bill and get it moving forward.
Hi, for the record, Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, and I want to thank Oliver and Orchid Health and Senator Pruzanski and this committee for being so patient as we did this. We literally agreed to this about 20 minutes before the hearing. So we have sent the language to the committee chair, and hopefully we can have that back pretty soon and move this next week. And again, it will allow for the folks like Orchid to be a certified rural health care clinic and be for-profit or nonprofit entity. Sure. And still keeps the statute that we had concerns about fairly clean. So we appreciate, again, all of the time and back and forth. So thank you.
That's great. Okay, I will just close the work session on 485. We'll wait for the paperwork to catch up. And tomorrow we will be posting all bills that will be still kept alive. And I don't know when Oliver is going to have them posted. By 12 noon. But then, so please watch. And then we have till midnight to add any more if we forgot something, but I just doubt that will happen. Okay, we're adjourned.